Hello, America. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Lisa Stewart, Cliff Stewart, and our special contributing analyst, Lamont Banks. How is everyone doing this evening?
Doing great.
Our phone number is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. We want you to stick around. We're going to have a pretty in-depth conversation later on with Professor Samuel R. Gross. He's a professor at law at the University of Michigan, and he is basically one of the founders of the National Registry, the ExonerationRegistry.org. And then we also have Professor James Liedman. He's a professor of law at Columbia University Law School. So we're going to be talking about innocent people who are sentenced to death, people who are on death row, and also those that may have been found innocent after execution. I mean, you know, and we were having a little bit of talk before we came on the air, and I know Lisa and Lamont, you were both saying, you know, that's one of the reasons, that's justification for reform in this area. I mean, when you talk about executing people who are innocent, and they, no one knows what that number is. So we're going to talk a little bit about that a little later on. Also, let me see here. We got some things that's going to come up in the news that we're going to be talking about. But before we do that, let's do our disclaimer, Lisa.
Yes, we want to remind everyone that we're not attorneys, and a Just Cause Coast to Coast does not provide legal advice. You want to contact your personal legal advisor for your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests do not necessarily reflect that of a Just Cause or a Just Cause Coast to Coast. And as always, thank you for tuning in and choosing to spend time with us this evening.
And, you know, we often talk about the IRP 6 and the case there. We invite our listeners to go out to freetheirp6.org. Freetheirp6.org, and we ask that you would keep them in prayer. We're talking about David Banks, Dave Zerpolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. That you would just, you know, one of the things on this case is the fact of there's several points that are under appeal, and we as a Just Cause are still fighting for their exoneration. But, you know, when you look at the particularly look at the Fifth Amendment right violation where they were forced to take the stand and then the transcript pertaining to that was never turned over. And yet you have several accounts of other courts where even like where Just Cause sued in civil court for release of it. And you had Judge Jackson who said, you know, something happened. You had retired federal appellate judge H. Lee Sarakin. He reviewed the case. He said, something happened. Something is missing. This is atrocious. And we are continuing to fight for that transcript because it is a key to the guy's exoneration. So, Lisa, what are we doing on that?
We've got a petition going on right now on change.org. And, Sam, you said we added another one, didn't you? MoveOn.org. MoveOn.org. We've got petitions out there. You need to go to those sites and search for IRP6. We want you to sign the petition. We're requesting that the Justice Department order an investigation and demand the release of the missing sidebar from the trial proceedings that shows that the men's Fifth Amendment rights were violated.
And then as far as phone calls?
And we're also urging everyone who has the ability to make a phone call to the Department of Justice at area code 202-514-2003 or 2005, I'm sorry. Call Eric Holder's office and ask them. We're asking them to do the same thing. We're looking for them to investigate the situation and get some answers as to what happened to that missing portion of that transcript that shows that violation.
And, you know, it's a very reasonable request. I mean, you have six gentlemen who have been wrongly incarcerated now for over 2 years, and it stands to reason that if there's even an inkling that something wrong went down in this case, someone should look into it.
It needs to be investigated. Yes.
And if they find that nothing happened, then at least you looked into it. But we know that something happened.
Absolutely.
And we know that they're going to find that something happened to include, you know, the things that happened with the jury, Cliff.
That's right. You know, in this case, the jurors were told one thing in open court. and Told Another Thing Behind Closed Door by Judge Christine Arguello. They also saw when she took expert witness Andrew Albarelli off the stand and would not allow him to testify. They saw when she wouldn't allow, signed affidavits by the retired federal agent Gary Hilberry. She wouldn't allow that to be seen. So you have these issues of not allowing testimony by defense witnesses, not allowing evidence. And then, obviously, this Fifth Amendment violation that happened at the sidebar that mysteriously is not in the transcript. And it's one thing, if we were just saying, hey, there's something, that's not in the transcript, it's not there. But when the judge herself says, yeah, there's something I said that does not show up in the transcript, and I don't know what it is that I said, but I didn't violate your Fifth Amendment right. Those type of things that need to be investigated, those type of things that just throw up all kind of questions. And so for the jurors, if you want all that information that we have about those issues I just spoke about, get in touch with us. You can reach us via phone at 855-529-4252. Again, that's 855-529-4252. Or send us an email at contact@a-justcause.com.
And again, for more information about the IRP6 case, you can go to freetheirp6.org. We would ask also that if you like information about A Just Cause, go to a-justcause.com. We are also seeking donations. Be mindful that donations to A Just Cause are not tax deductible, so you need to talk to your tax advisor as far as those type of things. But we still ask that you click on that donate button. We could use your assistance. For archives of A Just Cause programming, you can go to ajcradio.com or live365.com for 24/7 programming. And you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and then every Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time, you can catch us on Progressive Radio Network, and that is through PRN.FM. Again, our phone number this evening is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. So, Cliff, let's go to the news. Let's see what some things that are in the news. There's a lot goes on every day, but in the last couple of days, what's some of the things that's going on?
Yeah, I wanted to talk to about this this issue in Ferguson, Missouri, where the grand jury that's been impaneled to see if they bring the police officer up on charges. The grand jury is now being investigated for misconduct. And so what it's saying is that the St. Louis County Prosecutor's Office is investigating an accusation of misconduct on the grand jury that's hearing the case against Ferguson police officer. What was his name again? Wilson. Yeah, Darren Wilson. And one of the one of the grand jurors out there tweeting about what they're talking about in the grand jury room. Now, I mean, come on. It's one thing to say, I talked about something when I was at work. I put some stuff on my Facebook that shouldn't have been there. But you're talking about you're a grand juror. You've been impaneled to deal with a murder case, and you're tweeting about it. And it says in one of the message, a person tweeted that they're friends with a member of the jury who doesn't believe there's enough evidence to warrant an arrest of the officer, Darren Wilson. So this grand jurist is out there tweeting, I don't think there's enough evidence. And then after that, they find out that this person is friends with activist for Darren Wilson,
yep,
the police,
yep,
officer. So it's like, okay, what are you doing on the grand jury anyway? So they're saying that the attorney for the Browns family, Ben Crump, said that this potential breach must be fully investigated. Quote, if this allegation is true and there's a member of the grand jury who's discussing the case with a Darren Williams supporter, the appropriate thing for the prosecutor to do is impanel a new grand jury. If this person is discussing the case outside of the grand jury, it is wholly inappropriate. It's an issue of fairness for Michael Brown's family. And they said at a time where so many people in Ferguson already don't believe the prosecutor, Bob McCullough, will take this case seriously, this potential leak is a disaster. And then it says if it's found to be true and the grand jury has to be dismantled, then McCullough should be taken off the case immediately and replaced by a special prosecutor. And basically that's what the people of Ferguson were asking for in the first place, that McCullough, who is this prosecutor, that he be taken off the case. that he not deal with it because, you know, he's kind of known to be a racist. And so they're saying we need to get rid of him. We need to get somebody who is at least has shown that they're not biased. So we'll keep on top of that news for you. And as we get updates on it, we'll update you guys. But I think that grand jurist definitely, that whole grand jury needs to be, you know, they needed to impanel a new one, because that is totally crazy. You're like, yeah, well, I got an activist in here. I got a supporter for the police officer. Yeah, they're going to make sure that he's not brought up on charges. But then, you know, you might have people end up shooting them in the streets. So we'll see what happens.
Well, and, you know, they're bracing them for a long weekend in that area, because, I mean, we won't go into it, but there was another shooting in St. Louis, and they're saying that a young black teen was shot 17 times.
Right.
And so there is a great disparity in that case as to whether he was holding a weapon or whether he was holding a sandwich. And if he was holding,
that's what they're saying.
Yeah, seriously.
They're saying the cop says he's holding a weapon.
A weapon.
And he shot at him
and
three times.
And his family
times.
Is saying that he had a sandwich.
If witnesses are saying he was holding a sandwich. So let's see.
And that justified 17 shots. If he had a gun, that didn't justify 17 shots.
Well, we have new deadly weapons. Let's see. With Trayvon, he had Skittles and, what was it, iced tea? That's deadly. And now we have a sandwich as a deadly weapon.
And then in Florida, in the Dunn case, he had a boom box with music.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so.
If you happen to be African American and you have Skittles, iced tea, a boom box, or a sandwich, the police will come to get you. So be careful out there.
And, you know, that goes right into the next story where, you know, you have a kid in North Carolina.
Right.
Now, this one is really good in the sense that it's interesting from the standpoint that you have an African-American kid who is his foster parents are white.
Right.
They live in a nice neighborhood, nice home. And, you know, we printed off the story, but I saw it on the news this morning as well. And one of the neighbors calls it in saying that there is a black guy with dreads walking around the side of the house, and he just went in the house. And so, you know, they filed this intruder alert, basically. Cops show up. The kid is trying to explain that I live here. And in so many words, they're basically saying, sure you do. You know, show us some ID. And so they see pictures of white kids on the wall, a white family and everything. And he's trying to prove to them that he lives there.
Mm-hmm.
And because they didn't like those answers, they pepper spray him.
Yep, in his own house. You're standing in your living room. The cops come in and pepper spray you. And see, this is what gets me about the power of law enforcement. Because on the word of a neighbor, they can basically break into your house and attack you with just because they say, well, your neighbor said you're intruding. So if my neighbor came to got upset with me about whatever, called the cops, said, hey, there's a black guy just broke into a house in this neighborhood up here. He looks like an intruder. The cops come and come in my house without knocking, just pretty much break in and say, what are you doing in this house? And I tell them, I live here. Why are you in my house?
Exactly.
And they say, well, you must not live here because this neighborhood is not one that is conducive to your
kind.
Right, to your ethnic persuasion. And they pepper sprayed this kid in his own house. And, you know, I'm sure that now his parents, because, like you said, his adopted parents are white. They probably taught him all their life, you know, that, you know, there are some crazy people out there. But for the, you know, they've probably given him the racism lesson you know, there's good white people, there's good black people, and you also have the ones. But you were saying earlier, Sam, that they had his little sister.
His six-year-old sister. His white sister.
Right, right. His white stepsister. Like, why are they being mean to my brother? This kid doesn't understand. Obviously, she hasn't grown up with racist parents. And she's trying to figure out, why are they being mean to my brother? Why did the police pepper spray my brother?
And his parents even said, you know, this is so discouraging, so frustrating, so disturbing that, you know, that they would do this to our son. And just to see the way they responded to it on the air. You know that they are sincere. You know that they're genuine.
Right.
I mean, you know, something has to happen. And, you know, the writer of this article, and you can find it on MotherJones.com, the writer of this article actually, you know, took great exception to it. And if you look at the last line of this article, they say that in a surprising move, however, the cops did not appear to try to sprinkle some crack on him.
Huh.
It's like, you know, we're going to, it's like, you know, because it's proven that, you know, people will go to great extents to cover up, you know, their wrongdoing. It's like, no, this kid was doing something wrong. He was in his own house.
Yeah.
God.
That's sickening.
All right. So let's talk about this case of a death row inmate freed after 9 years in a Texas prison. So you have Manuel Velez has an IQ of 65, and they say that he's intellectually disabled. He is functionally illiterate both with English and Spanish, but he was convicted of killing, murdering, or participating in the murder of a 1-year-old kid, and sentenced to prison, and then sentenced to death row. Here's the kicker: he was 1,000 miles away.
1,000 miles away.
Working on a construction site in Tennessee when this happened. Now, this happened in Brownsville, Texas. Now, he was 1,000 miles away.
And, you know, the ACLU, when they got a hold of this and, you know, they fought for him, they said that, you know, he's indisputably innocent. He never should have been in prison, let alone on death row, waiting to be executed. But, it's good that he got out. Very sad that he went in and that you know, he had ineffective defense attorneys. They said his attorneys, they were, you know, state appointed, so he had court appointed attorneys, but they never did anything for him. Nothing. I mean, when you have the evidence that says this man was 1,000 miles away, and you don't present that to the judge, it's like, how does that happen? And this all came about because the child's mother, she pleaded guilty to abusing the child, but to get her plea deal, she had to basically say that he participated.
It's, yep,
like, but I'm 1,000 miles away. How do they even accept that as a plea deal? That goes along the line, you know, of the eyewitness testimony that's flawed or false, or, you know, in this case, just a blatant lie because he was nowhere to be found.
Now check this out: he received the death penalty because a state prison expert presented false testimony to persuade the jury that Manuel posed a danger to society, and if given life without parole, if he had been given life without parole instead. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, here you have an innocent man, you got ineffective counsel, and then you have a state expert saying that, yeah, he poses a threat to society, so you have to give him the death penalty. And then they say that the statement that the police made him sign, as far as saying that he did commit it.
Right.
It was typewritten by the police officers in English.
Yeah, that he couldn't even read. Yeah, and then the other sad part about this is after the ACLU fights for him and basically is getting everything about to be turned out, the prosecutor still fights. Like, even though there's evidence there, we want him to do a plea deal to basically get out. So he had to plead no contest to a lesser charge. And then the prosecutor says that at no point did any court, trial, or appellate, or any jury make any finding that Mr. Velez was actually innocent of murdering the kid. So he's still fighting. He says, in fact, every time the issue was brought up, it was found to be without merit. It was and continues to be the position of the Cameron County District Attorney's Office that Manuel Velez did contribute to the death of Angel Moreno, who was the kid, and he was and is being punished for that crime. So the prosecutor just does not want to give up. It's like, it's proven this man was 1,000 miles away, but
yeah,
because it's on paper that he pled to a lesser charge, a no contest, so that he could get out. The prosecutor is still saying, no, we got to win, and it's because he contributed to killing this
kid. I think they need an integrity unit in Brownsville, Texas.
They need, they definitely need an integrity unit.
So as we talked about at the top of the program this evening, we're going to be talking about innocent people sentenced to death. And here you have Manuel Velez. He dodged a bullet, literally.
Oh, yeah.
On death row, spent 9 years. So, but when we come back shortly after the break, we're going to be joined by Samuel Gross, and then also later on by James Leidman. And during several of the breaks this evening, listeners, you're going to hear profiles of folks who were innocent and sentenced to death, or they may have been found innocent after, after execution. So if you normally step away during these breaks, you might want to stick around because these are some interesting profiles that we've pulled. This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number this evening is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
When does it stop being partly cloudy and start being partly sunny? Why is the word abbreviation so long? Are English muffins just muffins in England? Why is it called a washing line and not a drying line? Do fish get thirsty? If ghosts can walk through doors, why don't they fall through floors? Do you yawn when you sleep? If prunes are dried plums, how do they make prune juice? Why do doctors leave the room when you change? They're going to see you naked anyway. Do bald chefs wear hairnets? How much deeper would the ocean be if all the sponges were taken out? Do you believe someone who says they're a chronic liar? Why is sandwich bread square and sandwich meat round? Life's full of hard questions. Ask one more. You might just save a life.
According to the Death Penalty Information Center, there have been over 1,000 people executed in the United States since 1976. The center goes on to say that there is no way to tell how many of those 1,000 people may have been innocent. The Death Penalty Information Center lists several cases where there is strong evidence of innocence. This is the profile of Cameron Willingham, state of Texas, convicted in 1992, executed in 2004. After examining evidence from the capital prosecution of Cameron Willingham, four national arson experts concluded that the original investigation of Willingham's case was flawed, and it is possible the fire was accidental. The independent investigation reported by the Chicago Tribune found that prosecutors and arson investigators used arson theories that have since been repudiated by scientific advances. Willingham was executed in 2004 in Texas despite his consistent claims of innocence. He was convicted of murdering his three children in a 1991 house fire. Arson expert Gerald Hurst said, "There is nothing to suggest to any reasonable arson investigator that this was an arson fire. It was just a fire." Prior to the execution, Willingham's defense attorney presented expert testimony regarding the new arson investigation to the state's highest court, as well as to Texas Governor Rick Perry. No relief was granted, and Willingham was executed on February 17, 2004. Coincidentally, Less than a year after Willingham's execution, arson's evidence, presented by some of the same experts who had appealed for relief in Willingham's case, helped free Ernest Willis from Texas death row. The experts noted that the evidence in the Willingham case was nearly identical to the evidence used to exonerate Cameron Willingham. For more information on this and other cases on the execution of possibly innocent people, go to deathpenaltyinfo.org.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Lisa Stewart, Cliff Stewart, and special contributing analyst Lamont Banks. Our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. You know, Lamont, lately we've been addressing the issue of pro se litigation because very often we get asked the question of the IRP 6. You know, why did they go pro se? And I know you've done quite a bit of research on this.
Yeah, and we were talking about this on the last show as well. The perception, if you will, of people that go pro se is very negative. Most people, the consensus is that if you go pro se, it's not smart. It's not a good thing to do. It's something that we should avoid at all costs. But statistically and history tells us quite a different story, and we want to just make aware to the listeners that pro se is an option that was thought of and put together by our forefathers of this country for the right of individuals to defend themselves. Our belief is that that is in place for the simple fact of where we are today as a country with court-appointed attorneys, public defenders, workloads being too much, unable to give a proper defense in a case. And so a person has the right to defend themselves and to face those that accuse them and to make an argument and to fight for justice. Unfortunately, I think the sad part about this is that we live in a time now that you are forced as the defendant to prove that you did not do it. And the law states that it is on the burden of the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you have committed a crime.
Right.
However, that's not the case in this day and age in which we live. You have to go in there and prove that you are innocent, which goes against everything that our forefathers had in mind at the beginning anyway. So pro se is something that's been going on a long time. Statistically, we gave those numbers a couple of weeks ago that about a third of the people that go pro se actually fare almost equal to those that have counsel when it comes to convictions and then not guilty verdicts in those cases.
And, you know, we have dissected the IRP 6 case, and by all accounts, the IRP 6 did a stellar job of representing themselves, but when there's an imbalance, and when you have the manner in which the court proceedings were handled, and we've talked about it before, in several instances, the gentlemen were held to a higher standard than those who are represented by trained counsel.
That's right. I mean, when you have a pro se litigant, it is the judge's responsibility, as well as the prosecutor, but especially the judge, to ensure that that pro se defendant is allowed to represent their evidence, to present their witnesses, to not be taken advantage of by the court or by the prosecutor. Of course, in the case with Christine Arguello, an IRP 6 case, she did just the opposite. She ensured that, like we said earlier, that their evidence was withheld, that their expert witness wasn't allowed to testify, and that when there was a sidebar and she told them one of them would have to take the stand, she has ensured that that portion of the transcript has never come to light. And how does a judge say, yeah, I did say something, that's not on the record. That makes absolutely no sense. I don't know what it is that I said, but I did say something that's not on the record. And then how does that get bypassed? How does that get just skipped in every process of the court? And but then everybody says, well, you know, no, they never should have gone pro se, because to go pro se, you know, you basically are shooting yourself in the foot. Well, if you do a great job in your pro se defense, but then you have the judge fighting against you, then what are you to do in that situation? There is no recourse. And then, you know, you go to the appellate court, and the appellate court says, well, yeah, we're just not going to deal with it. So,
and I think one point to add, I was checking some information out of groups out there that actually are looking for people to continue to stand up. I quoted David Banks last week, one of the IRP6, that stated that it is unreasonable to believe that we are to put a trust in a system. Now, whenever the system, and I don't know, I'm not old enough to go far back enough to know when the system was working, but I'm pretty sure I wasn't alive at that time, because the system has been broke for so long. But he made a good point that, and this particular quote, they say here that they believe that we got in this mess because we, the people, have allowed our legal system to get out of control. And as a result of that, we have to understand that there are people that are not trustworthy. As I explained to someone a couple weeks ago, the corruption starts from the time the handcuffs are put on you all the way to the appellate court, and even in many cases to the highest court in the land. So it's a matter, this is war that we're in right now. This is something that is going to take people to come together and stand. The statement is said all the time, right will never wrong itself. Well, excuse me, wrong will never right itself. So I apologize for that, but it just doesn't work that way. So, you know, we would say to everybody that, you know, before you make a judgment call on a group of men that maybe you're not aware of the specifics of this case, that was the best route for justice for these men, and that's what they needed to do. And as they stated, David Banks said before, they wouldn't do anything differently from what they've done.
That's right. And go ahead, Lisa, you were going to say something.
And one thing I think a lot of people don't realize is that the prosecutors, their job is not to get convictions. Their job is to make sure that justice is served. But that's not what they're doing. They're trying to maintain their high conviction rate. That's why they're able to push aside when they see proof, when they see things that prove that that would cause them to lose their case. They don't allow that to be presented. They do everything they can to keep it from being known by the public, by the jury, by the judge. If you have a judge that's not corrupt, they do everything they can to hide those facts, because they don't want to lose. They don't want to not get that conviction. But that is not their job. Their job is to make sure justice is served, and that's what they are not doing. We have the majority of the prosecutors out there are not in any way seeking justice. They're seeking a conviction, period.
That's it. They are looking for that. They want to maintain their 99% conviction rate, just like we talked about in this this situation with Mr. Velez that just got off death row. That prosecutor is still trying to hold to, like, no, he was, the reason he's being punished is because he played a part in this child's death when he was 1,000 miles away. And the evidence proves that. But because they have it on paper, they continue to try to hold to that conviction rate, that we do not want to lose that conviction. Sure, we'll let him out that he's innocent, but make him plead no contest to a lesser charge. But also for the audience, you have to understand that if your attorney in court does not make an objection to something that happens during the court proceeding, you cannot bring that up on appeal. It has to be preserved for appeal. So if the prosecutor gets up there and he's telling all kind of lies on you, or he's taking the law and twisting it and turning it to for his benefit, if your attorney does not object to what he is doing, you cannot bring that up on appeal.
That's right.
If you're in court for a robbery, and the prosecutor says, and by the way, he took a couple shots at the president last week, and your attorney does not object to that, you cannot bring up on appeal that the prosecutor lied about you trying to assassinate the president. So a lot of people don't understand that that is what happens. That is what is on the table. So to have an attorney that you've already seen that this attorney is not going to fight for me. In the IRP 6 case, they had these attorneys for a year. They had not gone over any of the discovery. They hadn't looked at any evidence. They hadn't interviewed any potential witnesses. Nothing. And so if you see them doing that before the trial, you know that during the trial that the likelihood of them fighting for you is very low. So instead of taking that chance of them not fighting and you having nothing preserved for appeal, you know, you fight for yourself.
And, you know, I think you can also look at this from a couple of different areas. I mean, you can look at it from the prosecutorial misconduct level at all levels, mm-hmm. you know, local, state, federal, whatever. And then also when it comes to judges and Judge H. Lee Sarakin, the retired federal judge who looked into the IRP 6 case, just over the last couple of days, he wrote an article on the Huffington Post, and it says, "For sale, going fast, an independent judiciary." And basically he's saying that the way that the system is supposed to work is going by the wayside. And then he has a caption here that says, "Buy a judge today." So he's playing off of an article that was in the New York Times that talks about retention elections, where, you know, judges are elected. But then, you know, you have these support groups, if you will, that may be funded by millionaires, billionaires, whatever, mm-hmm. that are contributing, you know, as much as $1 million to a local judge election.
Right.
And he particularly looked at three judges in Tennessee. And so Judge Sarakin, he's saying, could you imagine a lawyer or a litigant walking up to a judge in the middle of a trial and handing the judge a check for his or her campaign? And he said it wouldn't make any difference if the check was delivered a week before. And isn't it even worse now that the big boys are coming with even bigger checks? So basically he's saying that even at the lower court level, judges do not need to be elected. They do not need to be influenced by someone else's checkbook, because the way Judge Sarakin is saying it, he's saying that, you know, there's no doubt that there are people out there and even corporations who contribute to judicial campaigns for the purpose of electing or retaining judges who are fair, competent, and impartial. But then he goes on to say, and who carry out the applicable laws and enforce the state and federal constitutions. But then he says, but then there's the other 99% who wish to influence particular matters or judicial philosophy in general. And so he's saying, you know, there is 1% of people out there who, you know, they may be contributing to a judge's election. But, you know, for the majority, those who have the deep pockets and those who are contributing, they have there's some ill will, you know, something sinister behind their donations. So at any rate, we, you know, want to be sure that you go out to Huffington Post and check out that article and a lot of information there as far as, you know, the way things should go. But, you know, when you have someone who has been in the fight and has been on the judiciary, been right on the bench, and knows how it should work, and seeing the trend that's coming, there's a lot of problems. Yes. All right, let's shift gears. We are going to talk tonight about innocent people who are sentenced to death, as well as, you know, some of those who may have been found innocent after execution. We're going to talk to Samuel Gross. He is the editor of the National Registry of Exonerations. So first we're going to talk about, you know, those who have been wrongfully incarcerated, those who've been on death row, but now exonerated. So Professor Gross is going to talk to us a little bit about that, and then we're going to have Professor Lightman join us a little bit later. Professor Gross, how are you doing this evening?
I'm very well, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Professor Gross is professor of law at the University of Michigan, and as I stated before, editor of the National Registry of Exonerations, which launched only in May of 2012. But the registry has a lot of names on it. Tell us about it.
Well, the National Registry of Exonerations collects all cases of exonerations that we know about and can find since 1989. We now have 1,438 cases. When we started the registry in 2012, in May 2012, we had 891. So we've been adding over 200 a year. About a third or a little bit more of those are exonerations which occur at about the time that we find out about them and write them up and post them. About almost two-thirds are older cases, exonerations that occurred years, sometimes decades before, that we didn't know about. And we think there are still many more out there, people who were convicted falsely, imprisoned, and ultimately exonerated and released, but not in cases that are well-known enough so that they made it onto everybody's radar screens.
And what are we finding as far as the types of cases? And I guess, you know, what's some of the reasons that later on, I know DNA testing is contributing to a lot of the exonerations now.
Yes, quite a few of the exonerations are based on DNA, and people have heard so much about DNA cases that they often think that all the exonerations that we know about are based on DNA, but that's not the case. So of the exonerations that I mentioned, 1,438, fewer than a third involve DNA, something like 380 or so have any DNA evidence at all. The number of exonerations that the Innocence Project's list that include DNA is actually even smaller, because they only count cases in which DNA was a determinative factor. I think they have something like 318 at this point. So most people who are exonerated are freed and released by other types of evidence. And that makes a lot of sense, because DNA evidence is not available in lots of cases. It's available in rape cases, because the criminals in those cases leave biological trace evidence. It's available in some other cases in which criminals leave blood or sometimes sweat. But in most criminal convictions, there is no opportunity to use DNA. And the exonerations are based on other types of evidence, finding the real criminal, unanswerable evidence that person who was convicted couldn't have done it, in some cases where no crime ever occurred, witnesses or alleged victims who change their story and recant and say that the crime never occurred in the first place. There are a variety of ways in which people are exonerated without DNA, and that's the bulk of the cases.
Professor Gross, I have a question, because most of the times we look at the cases that we look at when you have an exoneration, even in the case we spoke about, the gentleman, Mr. Velez, that was on death row and got out after 9 years, you still have the prosecutors that are fighting them. And we know, you know, that with this 99% conviction rate, that the mass majority of the prosecutors, that's what they're about, getting their conviction. But we have to, you know, somewhere feel that there's moral ones out there that say, hey, it's about justice. If they're out there, why is their cry not, hey, let's just do DNA when there's DNA available? When someone comes up and says, hey, I have new evidence, why is there such a fight with these prosecutors against revisiting the evidence, if, you know, we are to believe that there are prosecutors out there who really want and seek justice, which is what their job is supposed to do, not to get a conviction, but to seek justice, where are they in the wrongful conviction process?
Well, it's a good question, and there isn't any simple answer. Prosecutors by now, on this question, on how willing they are to re-examine cases in light of new evidence of innocence after conviction, are all over the place. Some are exactly as you describe them, people who just resist and fight and stonewall and deny that there's any possibility that someone who was convicted by their office could possibly be innocent. And some are at the opposite extreme. Conspicuously, there are now probably something like 22 offices, prosecutorial offices around the country that have started conviction integrity units. The first and still by far the most important one, the one that's been involved in most exonerations, is the one in Dallas County, Texas, that was started by Craig Watkins when he got elected in 2006. He was a defense attorney by trade at that point. He was the first African-American who was ever elected as a district attorney in the history of Texas. And he was doing it in a county in which there were already quite a few DNA exonerations. And he said the prosecutor should help this process. And he's done a terrific job of doing that. The next most important one is the office of the Conviction Integrity Office in Kings County in Brooklyn, New York, which was involved in several exonerations before this past year, but has been moving up to a higher level and doing a much more thorough and careful job since Mr. Thompson was elected as district attorney last November. I guess it's over a year now. There are bunches of other ones around the country. Some of them, it's not clear that they're really doing anything. Some of them, people say, are just window dressing. But there certainly are prosecutors in the offices that have created conviction integrity units and elsewhere who do exactly what you think they ought to do. And then there are the other type. I think there is a movement in the right direction. I think the atmosphere is changing. I think that more prosecutors are willing to admit to mistakes and to consider that the innocent people may have been convicted. But there's certainly a long way to go. Why some of them still resisted, you'd have to ask them.
So, Professor Gross, I'm looking at your website and on the page that shows most recently added to the registry. What, there are 50 this year?
How many have we added? It depends what you mean by this year. We have, as I said, 1,438. So far this year, the number that have been exonerated in 2014 is rather larger than I'm going to get the total before I tell you. 71 as of today. We just added one today.
Oh, okay.
Exonerated this year. And there will be probably another couple of cases of people who were exonerated this year that will be added in the next 2 days. Last year, 2013, had the largest number of known exonerations in any single year. This year could possibly break that record again. There could be more than 90. We'll see.
And that right there tells you that there is a problem with our system. When you have greater than one person per week being exonerated after being wrongfully convicted, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. Joining us this evening, Professor Samuel Gross, editor of the National Registry of Exonerations. This evening we're talking about innocent people who were sentenced to death row or may have even been found innocent after execution. In this segment, we were just talking about just the situation of wrongful convictions and how many people have been wrongfully convicted and the exonerations. We're going to take a quick break and come back, and we're going to continue that dialogue. And then hopefully by that time, we'll be having Professor James Liebman joining us. Our phone number this evening is 347-838-8976. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, several of our breaks will be touching on some profiles of those who have been sentenced to death or may have been found innocent after execution. So stick around. We'll be right back. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Don't go anywhere.
According to the Death Penalty Information Center, there have been over 1,000 people executed in the United States since 1976. The center goes on to say that there is no way to tell how many of those 1,000 people may have been innocent. The Death Penalty Information Center lists several cases where there is strong evidence of innocence. This is the profile of Gary Graham, state of Texas, convicted in 1981, executed in 1995. According to the Death Penalty Information Center, on June 23, 2000, Gary Graham was executed in Texas despite claims he was innocent. Graham was 17 when he was charged with the 1981 robbery and shooting of Bobby Lambert outside a Houston supermarket. He was convicted primarily on the testimony of one witness, Bernadine Skillers, who said she saw the killer for a few seconds through her car windshield from a distance of 30 to 40 feet away. Two other witnesses, both who worked at the grocery store, and said they got a good look at the assailant, said Graham was not the killer, but were never interviewed by Graham's court-appointed attorney, Ronald Mott. The eyewitnesses who could have cleared Graham were not called to testify at trial. Three of the jurors who voted to convict Graham signed affidavits saying they would have voted differently had all of the evidence been available. For more information on this and other cases on the execution of possibly innocent people, go to deathpenaltyinfo.org.
You are listening to AJK Radio.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Lisa Stewart, Cliff Stewart, and our special contributing analyst, Lamont Banks. And joining us in the previous segment was Professor Samuel Gross, the editor of the National Registry of Exonerations. Now joining us, going to chime in on the conversation, is Professor James Liebman. He is professor of law at Columbia University Law School. And he's going to talk to us a little bit about our subject this evening as far as innocent people who are sentenced to death, or maybe even situations where you have someone that is found innocent after execution. But before we bring on Professor Liebman, Lamont, we were talking about something during the break, and and I know you had a question for Professor Gross.
Yes, and good evening, Professor Gross. Good to have you. Lamont Banks here. Had a quick question. Thank you. Clarification. I want to make sure I'm correct in what I heard, that that prosecutors are now starting to pay closer attention to wrongful convictions. They are starting to show themselves more concerned. Were you speaking of in the state of Texas or overall? Was that a general statement?
What I meant to say is that some prosecutors are, and as a group they are, because this is something that's catching on around the country to some extent. But it's not true of all prosecutors. It's not true of all prosecutors in any state that I know of. So in Texas, in Dallas County, it's very much true of District Attorney Craig Watkins. But Texas has over 100 counties, and some of them are very different from Dallas County.
Okay, and that was my question, because statistically, as we researched the system being completely broken and tore back, I'm aware that a great majority of prosecutors, and then again, we salute Mr. Watkins for what he's done down there in Texas and the good things that he's doing, and I just want a clarification of that, because the numbers that we see across this country as a whole, as the majority, we have a great number of prosecutors that don't share that same sentiment. As a result, the numbers are what they are, the incarceration rates are what they are, and the prosecutional misconduct statistics are what they are. And I just want to get clarification of that.
Okay.
All right. Excellent. All right. Thanks, Lamont. So, Professor Liebman, welcome to the program. I know that you have authored numerous articles on the death penalty, federal habeas corpus, equal protection, and the list goes on and on, and you've argued several habeas corpus and death penalty appeals in the United States Supreme Court. So, talking to Professor Gross, and you look at the great number of exonerations on an annual basis, and Professor Gross is saying, you know, that we're looking at probably busting another record. But then when you consider the fact how many people may have been on death row or executed that we don't even know who may have been innocent.
Yes, I think that's an important issue, and it's one that's very, very difficult to get at, because Once somebody is executed, not only does the government take the position that everything is over and there's nothing more to inquire into, that it must be taken as a given that the person who was executed was guilty. But it is also the case that the folks who work to protect the rights of criminal defendants also generally don't engage in those inquiries either, because they have so many other people who are in prison who need their services and support that they don't apply their efforts to those people. And that makes sense, because, you know, we want to protect people who are alive if we can. But we began doing in around 2000, 2003, 2004 was to look into a couple of cases where we thought there might be some concern about whether the person who was executed was innocent, in order to see what the risks actually might be in such cases. And the result of that, in one of the cases that we took a look at, is a book that I have just published with some former students of mine at Columbia called The Wrong Carlos: Anatomy of a Wrongful Execution, in which we tell the story of Carlos de Luna, who was executed by Texas in 1989 for a crime that we are convinced and believe we've provided a very convincing case in the book was committed by another man named Carlos Hernandez, who was left free even though he had been identified to the police as the man who actually committed the crime.
And what, as I read about the Carlos de Luna's case, there are eyewitnesses who even looked at photos and knew that that they had the wrong man. Yet,
well, what happened? Yes,
go ahead.
That's right. I mean, the problem is that these two Carloses looked exceptionally similar. They were both the same height and weight, and they resemble each other dramatically when you look at them. And we know this to be the case because, in the midst of our investigation, we showed pictures of each of those men to their own to relatives of the relatives and friends of the other man, and to for about two dozen people mistook a person who they thought was their relative or their friend or somebody they knew well. They actually mistook a picture of the other man as the person that they knew. And the problem with this case is that it stood on a single eyewitness identification, which was essentially the only evidence that Carlos de Luna had committed this crime. And it was an identification that was conducted under the absolute worst kinds of conditions. It was not a lineup or a photo array. It was actually Carlos de Luna brought back to the gas station where the crime had occurred, or brought to the gas station where the crime had occurred. And at night, in a parking lot where there were all sorts of bystanders crowding around, the police literally shined flashlights in Carlos de Luna's face, brought the witness over and said, "This is the man," who they were spotlighting, and said, "Is he the one who did it?" And of course, there was little the man could say, but yes, that's the man who did it, even though he told us later on that he was no more than 50% certain that they actually had shown him the person who committed the crime.
So why didn't the prosecutors take Carlos Hernandez serious, or maybe they just wanted to go with Carlos de Luna, in the sense that, okay, we have a person, and you know, in reading about it, it looks like they're saying that that this other person was a figment of Carlos de Luna's imagination, yet you have Carlos Hernandez basically out there bragging about committing the crime.
Yes, that's one of the big mysteries of the case. But we have a couple of thoughts or ideas or some evidence about what took place there. You've been talking to Professor Gross and others about, to some extent, prosecutors make mistakes. They get focused on one person. Once you think you have the right person, it's hard for people of any sort, but maybe particularly prosecutors, to change their mind. And so there's just this pressure that takes place once you arrest somebody to essentially view everything that you then look at after that point, every bit of evidence, from the perspective of what does it show about this man's guilt, rather than asking the right question, which is what does it show about some person's guilt, whether it's this person or somebody else's. So there's just a pressure to see the world as if it proves what your initial view was. But there's something else in this case that is actually two other things that are very troubling to us. The first one is that there were actually two victims of this miscarriage of justice, not only Carlos de Luna, who was executed for a crime that another man committed, but the victim of the crime, this woman who was alone in a gas station at night with no protection, named Wanda Lopez, who was killed knifed to death in this crime. And it turns out what we discovered in our investigation was that she had called the police 10 minutes earlier and said, "I hear from one of my customers that there's a man outside with a knife. Will you come over here and protect me?" And the police said, "No, don't worry about it, but if he comes inside, call us again." Well, she did call again, and in fact, the crime in this case took place while she was on the 911 call. But by that point, of course, it was way too late for the police to get there in time. And essentially what happened in this case was that the police knew that they had failed to protect this woman's life. If they had come at the time she had called them, they would have protected her life. And so they covered that fact up by destroying the tapes that showed the earlier phone call had taken place. But they also wanted to do everything they could to make it look like they had solved the crime quickly. And so once they had identified somebody quickly as the person who did it, they had this extra reason not to want to change their mind, because it then might have prompted an investigation into why they had failed to protect this woman. A third reason, there's yet another one, which is that it looks very much like Carlos Hernandez was a police informant, and there is evidence that the police tried to protect him and let him commit a lot of other crimes, including one other murder and actually two other murders of young Hispanic women in Corpus Christi, Texas, as well as a near murder of a third young Hispanic woman. And it may be that they were protecting him because he was involved in providing information to them in some way that they felt was more important than getting to justice in these other cases.
And Professor, I have a question. You know, you look at the the schools that you're affiliated with, Columbia, and then Dr. Gross is at the University of Michigan, and these schools with these law students take these issues up and try to help to find the innocent. And I've often wondered, we dealt with the fact that the prosecutors, they're pretty much they're looking for their conviction rate. They're not going to help fight the fight to find the innocent. But I've often wondered why no one in Congress will take up the fight. I mean, we know that, like, the Innocent Project, they're understaffed, they're underfunded. I'm sure, yeah, it's great. It's great practice for the law students, and they get great gratification for finding someone innocent. But would it not seem viable that the federal government would take up this issue, especially in death penalty cases where you have a person on death row? Would it not stand to reason that there would be some arm of the government that says, "Hey, if there is some semblance of new evidence, something that says that this person could be innocent, that the government would try to fight it"? And from your perspective, If you've done any research on that, what is it that has been found that why isn't this fight being taken up to save innocent lives in the event that they are innocent?
Well, it's a very good question. If you look, Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, they actually have national-level authority to appoint commissions to go and look into cases and identify whether people have been wrongfully convicted and wrongfully executed, and indeed in those countries have found that that actually occurred. That's why England got rid of the death penalty, largely because of some innocent people who were identified as having been executed by a so-called royal commission. It was a commission created under the auspices of the government. But in the United States, one problem is that criminal justice is a very local affair, and so there's a reluctance on the part of federal officials and even state officials in many ways to get involved in what is considered to be a local affair. But I actually want to add something to the point you made, which is even when it comes out through an investigation that students at a law school or some other way of all of the ways that Professor Gross was describing, that an exoneration occurs and it's clear that a very serious error was made, you would think at that point then there would be an investigation, right? If an airplane crashes, we have an investigation. Or, you know, something really bad happens that we all know is a terrible thing and should never happen again, there's an investigation to find out why. But that does not happen in our criminal justice system, and I think that's really something that we ought to change, because once you know something bad is happening, you can learn from that investigation what happened, and then you have a good set of ideas about what to do next time to avoid that.
Right, and not to cut you off, Sam, but also, you know, when we bring Professor Gross back on the other side of the break, I would like for him to address that as well, what his take is on that reason. So if you would, Professor, think of that while we go to break.
And Cliff, I was just going to say the same thing, because on the National Registry of Exonerations, it shows as far as a percentage of exonerations by contributing factor, almost 50%. I think it says 46%, that's based off of your current statistics, are attributed to official misconduct. And so, yeah, we definitely need to talk about that on the other side of the break. So joining us this evening, Professor James Liebman, professor of law at Columbia Law School, Columbia University School of Law, and then also Professor Samuel R. Gross with the National Registry of Exonerations. And this evening we're talking about innocent people who are sentenced to death row, or those who may have been found innocent after execution. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
According to the Death Penalty Information Center, there have been over 1,000 people executed in the United States since 1976. The center goes on to say that there is no way to tell how many of those 1,000 people may have been innocent. The Death Penalty Information Center lists several cases where there is strong evidence of innocence. This is the profile of Carlos de Luna, state of Texas, convicted in 1983 for the murder of Wanda Lopez. He was executed in 1989. According to the Death Penalty Information Center, Mr. DeLuna is at the center of one of the most comprehensive investigations ever undertaken by the execution of a possibly innocent defendant. Professor James Liebman and other researchers at Columbia University Law School published a groundbreaking report on the case of Carlos DeLuna entitled Anatomy of a Wrongful Execution, published in Columbia's Human Rights Law Review. Professor Liebman concluded that Luna was innocent and was wrongly convicted on the thinnest of evidence, a single nighttime cross-ethnic eyewitness identification, and no corroborating forensic. Luna maintained his innocence from
from the time of his arrest until his execution, claiming that the actual culprit was Carlos Hernandez. Prosecutors called Hernandez a phantom of DeLuna's imagination. Although Hernandez was known to police and prosecutors because of his history of violent crimes, including armed robberies and an arrest for murder similar to the one for which DeLuna was executed, that Hernandez spent years bragging around Corpus Christi, Texas, that he, not Carlos DeLuna, killed Wanda Lopez. For more information on this and other cases on the execution of possibly innocent people, go to deathpenaltyinfo.org.
Talk, news, politics, and inspiration.
According to the Death Penalty Information Center, there have been over 1,000 people executed in the United States since 1976. The center goes on to say that there is no way to tell how many of those 1,000 people may have been innocent. The Death Penalty Information Center lists several cases before and after 1976 where there is strong evidence of innocence. Here's one of their stories. This is the profile of Lena Baker, state of Georgia, convicted in 1944. She was executed in 1945. In 2005, 60 years after her execution, the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles issued a formal pardon for Lena Baker, the only woman executed in the state during the 20th century. The document signed by all five of the current board members noted that the parole board's 1945 decision to deny Baker clemency and allow her execution was a grievous error, as this case called out for mercy. Baker, an African American, was executed for the murder of Ernest Knight, a white man who hired her. Baker was tried, convicted, and sentenced to die in one day by an all-white, all-male jury. Baker claimed she shot Knight in self-defense after he locked her in his grist mill and threatened her with a metal pipe. The pardon notes that Baker could have been charged with voluntary manslaughter rather than murder for the death of E.B. Knight. The average sentence for voluntary manslaughter is 15 years in prison. Baker's picture and her last words are currently displayed near the retired electric chair at a museum at Georgia State Prison in Reidsville. Now, for more information on this and other cases on the execution of possibly innocent people, go to deathpenaltyinfo.org.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Joining us this evening, Professor Samuel Gross and Professor James Liebman. Cliff.
Yes, so Professor Gross, before we went to break, we heard from Professor Liebman about his take on the federal government, you know, taking action as far as checking into some of these cases, especially with the, you know, death penalty cases. But on a whole, when you have a individual that is, you know, one day in prison when you're innocent is too long. So what has been your research or your findings or just your opinion on what the federal government should be doing, could be doing as far as these wrongful conviction cases?
Well, I agree completely with what Professor Liebman said, that the federal government, and for that matter, most state governments, don't think they ought to get involved in actual prosecutions. Perhaps they're wrong. But what the federal government could do, and has not been doing as well as it is able, is sponsor programs and take actions that might help prevent wrongful convictions in the future.
Yes.
And that's probably the best thing that anybody can do in this area all around. We're more likely to save more people by preventing errors in the future than by trying to find them in the past. The federal government has occasionally done things on this. The Department of Justice, under Janet Reno, issued a very important report on lessons learned from the first several dozen DNA exonerations, but very little on anything of that sort since. I should say there's one exception. The federal government sponsored a major study on the unreliability of forensic evidence, of so-called forensic science evidence, which is often very bad science and leads to some wrongful convictions. But through the various units of the Department of Justice that sponsor local programs, the federal government could be doing a lot more to help create structures to avoid wrongful convictions and to do some of the things we were talking about in the first section of this program, to encourage prosecutors and police departments to take the issue more seriously, to provide funding for offices that are willing to do that, to identify cases in their jurisdictions locally where innocent people may have been convicted, and to investigate cases more carefully and correctly so that fewer of these errors ever happen in the first place.
And I have a question for both of the professors here, and maybe a statement question, if I can phrase it that way. And, you know, I'm sitting here looking at the story of a George Stinney who was convicted in 1944, 14 years old, for the killing of two girls in South Carolina. Executed, alibi, family says the 14-year-old was present with them the entire time that this crime supposedly occurred, weighing 95 pounds, very unlikely that he could have demonstrated or drug bodies or did whatever that they accused him of doing. This kid is 14 years old. Now, my concern is that this goes back as early as 1944. We have a gentleman, as I looked up some information, former Colorado Governor Bill Ritter granted a full unconditional pardon to a Joe Arity, who was convicted and executed as an accomplice to murder that occurred in 1936. His pardon came 72 years later. My concern is that we have penalties for people who commit crimes in this country, murderers who kill people. Our justice system has become the role of mercenaries. And that is the most horrific and tragic thing. As I read these statistics, the fact that the numbers are what they are today should demand for immediate action by the United States, the federal government. It is, and I understand the professor made the point that a lot of these things are local. Well, when local fails to do what they are supposed to do, we depend on the federal government to step in Washington and say, you know what? And our legislators to say, this is an outrage. And I'm starting to really wonder, as we sit here and we talk about other countries and what they do and what their justice system is doing, I'm sitting here page by page comparing the horrific activities of this country to their citizens of innocent lives. You're simply killing people. And I'm appalled at the fact that the people sit in Congress and they get involved with all type of causes. What do we do about taking innocent lives? We got people marching around Congress saying abortion kills. Well, you're killing people every day. What are we going to do about that? It's unbelievable to me. I salute what you guys do, but as I sit here, I'm appalled, man. The faith in this system. The system has failed. America has lost its way, and they're way, way lost right now. I'm appalled by this.
Yeah, and you know, to that point, Lamont, you know, there's some things that you see Congress take up that you say, okay,
You know, this is totally atrocious. You know, sometimes they call it, you know, pork fat or whatever they add to the bill to say this is what they want to get. And one case in point, a couple years ago when the movie came out about how SEAL Team 6 took out Osama bin Laden, and Senator McCain, you know, wrote a letter to the studios in Hollywood saying, you guys depicted the SEALs the wrong way. You might have the American people, you know, looking at them thinking they commit torture, and that's not what we stand for. And granted, you know, we don't want to, you know, whether America commits torture or not, we don't want the rest of the world that much in our business. But for him to take up that cause and say, you know, we need to deal with this, we need to make sure the American people don't see our special forces and our armed forces this way. Well, how about writing a letter saying, hey, we need to ensure that a person that's crying out from death row or in solitary confinement or in a cell for years and decades on end that is saying that I'm innocent. Why can we not reach out and spend federal money on things like that? You take the bridge to nowhere. Federal money was spent on that, and the bridge went absolutely nowhere. Went up and back down for no particular reason. And that is my contention, is that, you know, Congress fights for some things that, obviously just my opinion, are ludicrous issues. And with this, like Lamont said, I mean, these are lives. These are people locked up. In a lot of cases for no particular reason. And I think that there should be some type of fight from Congress to take that up. And even on the local side, that, you know, Congress should force the states to say, hey, you're going to have something in place that can fight this. It shouldn't be left up just to the schools. It shouldn't be left up to professors like you two gentlemen to say we're going to be the ones fighting the fight. The whole country should be doing it.
Professor Liebman,
I don't think you need to convince either of us.
No, I believe that I just you know, it's just something that I want to put out there, because, you know, you guys have classes, have you know, law students that are, you know, given their free time to take up this cause. You know, you have the Innocence Project that you know, for the most part, they're a volunteer organization, but it's not enough. You know, when you see them doing advertisements and they have file cabinets and cabinets full of cases that they haven't even reviewed yet, it's an atrocity. And we, as the American people, our tax dollars are spent on much less, you know, much more frivolous things, I'll say. Charlisa, you had a comment about that.
Yeah, I just had a question for Professor Gross. Exactly, how do you determine which cases that you're going to share with your students as far as researching these issues? How do you determine which cases you reach out and look into? And also, second part to that question, can an advocacy group submit wrongful conviction cases for them to review?
Well, actually, the reviewing is actually not done by students anymore. It's done by a very small staff of two people. And we basically try to locate any cases that we can that meet our criteria for counting as an exoneration, which means that the person was convicted of a crime, not just charged, that the consequences of the conviction were completely erased, that there was acquitted or all charges were dismissed, or the convicted person got a pardon, and that the process that led to that, one of those outcomes, included a substantial amount of new evidence of innocence that wasn't presented at the first trial. And those are the criteria that we use, and we try to find as many cases as we can, but from any source. We, you know, we get some cases from lawyers, occasionally from journalists, we recently got one from the person who was exonerated himself, saying, this is what happened to me, I don't think you noticed. And we said, thank you, we didn't. It was a case that happened just recently and got very little attention. So absolutely, we'd be interested in hearing from anybody. But I should make clear, the National Registry of Exonerations is not an innocence project. We don't represent people. We don't have a attorney-client relationship with anybody. It's a research enterprise. We don't deal with confidential information. And the organizations that do that are, as you say, overworked and have limited resources. And I'm very happy that they're able to do what they're able to do. But if we help, it's by collecting information.
Okay, thank you.
Professor Liebman, now you have quite extensive experience with regard to clerking for a judge at the U.S. Court of Appeals and then also clerk for Justice John Paul Stevens in the United States Supreme Court. And you've written extensively on habeas corpus practice and procedure. And as we were talking just a few moments ago, as far as, you know, why do we have so much error? What's your cut on the role of, especially if that error can be pointed back to prosecutors, what's your cut on, you know, the role of the Inspector General's office or the Office of Professional Responsibility? I mean, I know the experience that a Just Cause has had with the Office of Professional Responsibility, and then as I study about it, it looks like it has no respect even with among its own ranks. But where do you think, you know, where does the responsibility lie with looking into and fully investigating these situations of misconduct?
Well, I think as Professor Gross pointed out, you've got multiple problems. You've got problems kind of at every level. And nobody, looks into these cases to see if somebody may be innocent. After it's been proven that they're innocent, people are not looking into the cases to figure out why and take steps to prevent it. And when it happens that it is clear that people contributed in very serious, egregious ways to the conviction of somebody who is innocent, very rarely are steps taken to punish those people, to take their jobs away from them, or in other ways take steps to make clear that these things are taken seriously. This is particularly true with law enforcement and prosecutors. And so I think there's a lot of blame to go around. And I think, you know, we live in a country where people, the fear of crime and that they're at risk from other people in many ways overcomes the concern for the fact that we may be overzealous in some cases and move further than we should have moved given what the evidence shows. I actually want to point out one very simple thing that we could do that I think it'd be hard for me to imagine any American who would be against this, and yet we don't do it. And that is that DNA, or evidence that has DNA evidence or DNA material on it, is available in the record of a large proportion of people who have been executed in the United States. Not everybody, but in a large proportion. Many of those people were executed before DNA analysis was as good as it is today, so either it didn't take place at all or it didn't take place in a rigorous way that we would be able to do it now. And for me, it seems to me the obvious thing to do, particularly in capital cases where we have so much at risk, would be to say when that evidence is available, it should be preserved and it should be made available for testing if there's somebody willing to pay for that testing to take place. And that is definitely the case in many situations. The press would pay for it, members of the public would pay for it, and all of that. But the fact is that that evidence is treated as the private property, in essence, of prosecutors. And though they have the evidence, and it could easily demonstrate their claims that they never make mistakes in these cases, but they're unwilling to allow it to be tested. And it seems to me that that's a very good indicator of how little faith they have in the product of their own work. And it seems to me one simple way to really bring out how bad, or maybe not, you know, how not so bad things are, would just be to test what's out there and come up with a number. This is how often we get it wrong in these cases. Then we'd know.
Joining us this evening, Professors James Liebman and Samuel Gross. We're talking about innocent people being sentenced to death or those found innocent after execution. And also just talking about the those who have been on death row or sentenced to life in prison and have been exonerated. So we're going to come back and get some closing thoughts from Professor Gross and Professor Liebman. We're going to take a quick break. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Don't go anywhere.
According to the Death Penalty Information Center, there has been over 1,000 people executed in the United States since 1976. The center goes on to say that there is no way to tell how many of those 1,000 people may have been innocent. The Death Penalty Information Center lists several cases where there is strong evidence of innocence. This is the profile of Larry Griffin, state of Missouri, convicted in 1981, executed in 1995. According to the Death Penalty Information Center, a year-long investigation was conducted by the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, and it uncovered evidence that Larry Griffin may have been innocent of the crime for which he was executed by the state of Missouri on June 21, 1995. Griffin maintained his innocence until his death, and investigators say his case is the strongest demonstration yet of an execution of an innocent man. The report notes that a man injured in the same drive-by shooting that claimed the life of Quentin Moss says Griffin was not involved in the crime. And the first police officer on the scene has given a new account that undermines the trial testimony of the only witness who identified Griffin as the murderer. Based on his findings, the NAACP has supplied the prosecution with the names of three men it suspects committed the crime, and all three of the suspects are currently in jail for other murders. Prosecutor Jennifer Joyce says she has reopened the investigation and will conduct a comprehensive review of the case over the next few months. There is no real doubt that we have an innocent person. If we could go to trial on this case, if there was a forum where we could take this to trial, we would win hands down, stated University of Michigan law professor Samuel Gross, who supervised the investigation into Griffin's case. While there is extensive evidence of Griffin's innocence, in 2007, the St. Louis Circuit Attorney issued a report for standing by the original conviction. For more information on this and other cases on the execution of possibly innocent people, go to deathpenaltyinfo.org.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Joining us this evening are Professor Samuel Gross, the National Registry of Exonerations, and then also Professor James Liebman, Professor of Law at the Columbia University School of Law. Gentlemen, thanks again for joining us this evening. Before we get closing thoughts from you, I have a quick question for you both. Let's start with you, Professor Liebman. Regarding those with intellectual disabilities, and, you know, as I look at some information even on the Death Penalty Information Center, you know, they just published and posted the release of a new book out today saying mental disorder is never a crime. Care, don't kill. And it says that, you know, those with mental health problems, they don't even have the capacity to help themselves, to put together a proper defense. So, Professor Liebman, what do you think needs to be done in this area? And I don't know if you have statistics that you can share, or even if Professor Gross has any kind of statistics that you could share with regard to people who may have been incarcerated, executed, who had mental disabilities.
Well, I'm going to leave the statistics to Professor Gross because he's got them. I would just say that it is a big problem. In our book, The Wrong Carlos, Anatomy of a Wrongful Execution, which just came out this summer, we show that Carlos de Luna himself was intellectually disabled and was unable to finish the eighth grade because he simply couldn't master or perform in school. And he hurt himself badly at trial because he told a little lie. It was about something, it was a clear lie, no doubt about it, but it had nothing to do with, it didn't help him the least bit to prove his innocence or even, you know, create a story of innocence. It's just something he said along the way that was not true. Well, it's something that his lawyers should have realized he didn't understand what he was doing and should have prevented him from doing that. But it shows you how people who have intellectual disabilities are particularly at risk in these situations, and I think are particularly prone to be people who are convicted and potentially executed when they're innocent. And it's something that the system needs to be much more attentive to than it has been. But the evidence of these kinds of disabilities is not always taken seriously and in many cases is ignored.
Well, you know, we just had a case in North Carolina where the two half-brothers they spent 30 years in prison. And you know, it comes out after their exoneration that they both had mental disabilities. And but, you know, after several hours of interrogation, you know, they finally confessed to a crime that they didn't do. So, as you say, you know, there are special circumstances and situations that these people with mental disabilities shouldn't be put in those kinds of circumstances. Okay, Professor Gross.
Well, that's a perfect lead into what I was going to say, which is the National Registry of Exoneration, we have a relatively small number of people with mental disabilities that we know about, 96 out of 1,438, maybe about 6-7% or something like that. There may be many more. It's not information that's necessarily available to us because in some of these cases we know very little about the case. There's not some of them we know an enormous amount. Some of them have more than one book written about them. Some of them just several pieces of paper. But the ones that we know about are heavily concentrated among people who falsely confessed and then eventually were proven to be innocent despite the confession, like the two cases that you just mentioned from North Carolina, Mr. McCollum and Mr. Brown. That's one situation in which it is very clear by now. If you are mentally disabled, you have limited intelligence, serious learning disabilities, or some mental illness, and you're interrogated by police officers for a long period of time, the chances that you will confess whether or not you did it appear to be very high. And some law enforcement people, including conspicuously the prosecutor in that county in North Carolina, who now, 30 years after the fact, after they've been exonerated, after we have DNA evidence that points to the real criminal who went on to victimize other women because they didn't follow up on evidence that he was the actual criminal in the case for which Mr. McCollum and Brown were sentenced to death, after all of that, he still says, I think they're guilty. Why? Well, I think some prosecutors and police officers just cannot believe that a confession they took is false. If it's a confession and they were involved in it, that means the guy is guilty. And that is a blind spot that is just terrifying.
And I would go to the extent of saying that's more than a blind spot, that's a blatant spot. I mean, because, you know, when you look at prosecutors that take that type of stand, even in light of the overwhelming evidence of innocence, I mean, we were talking about the story of Manuel Velez, who was just released yesterday. Same situation.
Right.
I mean, overwhelming evidence, you know, 1,000 miles away, yet at the end, the prosecutor is still saying, well, we still think he had something to do with it.
Yeah, and to that point that you made, Professor, I wanted to ask both of you what your take is on the prosecutor and judicial immunity that, you know, they get away with pretty much, you know, murder in some cases. And they have immunity from it, and we've talked about that a few times on the show. But to get your take on it, because you do the research and you see the cases, and when it comes back with prosecutorial misconduct or judicial misconduct, what is your take on the immunity of those two realms of the government?
Well, they have immunity from civil lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing they have immunity from. So prosecutors have nearly complete immunity from being sued for money damages. They don't have immunity for crimes they commit, and they don't have immunity from professional discipline for violating the rules of ethics of the legal profession. But what stands out about prosecutorial misconduct and other types of official misconduct is that almost nobody is ever disciplined or prosecuted by any of the authorities that could do it.
Yes.
Revising the rules on immunity from civil liability for damages might be a good idea, but it won't make any difference in the context in which everybody sort of closes ranks and says that case is over. They, you know, it wasn't their fault. They were trying to do the right thing, or whatever it is that makes everybody decide that discipline is not appropriate. I think it would be a good idea. I think the type of immunity that prosecutors have is way too broad. But if that was the only problem, they would be subjected to other types of discipline under the existing authority.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think another point that I think is very important is it's not just where you have individuals who did something wrong and are immune from what they did wrong. You have people where there are patterns, long-standing patterns,
right,
of violations that have occurred over time, that if you simply add up what courts have said in individual cases, you see patterns of violations like this. And it seems to me that even if we want to protect people on an individual case, we should be very attentive to the fact that if there are patterns of abuses and things like that, there should not be immunity. There should not be, there should be prosecution. There should be steps taken to take away law licenses and things like that. And I think the system is blind or blatant, whichever you want to say, when it comes to just ignoring these patterns. The prosecutor in the North Carolina case is a very good example. This was a particularly egregious situation, but by no means the only one where that prosecutor was involved.
And, yeah, and Professor Lamont Banks here chiming in on that. A concern that I have on one point, and again, not a question, but more of a comment to add what you're saying, is that a lot of times the existing authorities that are in place who brings disciplinary action for the conduct that's going on by these prosecutors, a lot of times is not for the public to see, as they say. It's a private sanction or censure or whatever they want to call it, and they'll do that. And many times it's a slap on the wrist. It's not nothing that is substantial enough that will curb the behavior. And I think that's one of the major problems you have. If a man's life or a woman's life is incarcerated for a year, a day, a month, whatever, that's a nightmare for people who should not be there. So because the penalty that those people suffer as a result of their conduct, their punishment without question does not fit the crime that they've committed and the lives that have been affected and the families that have been affected. So you can take their bar license away, which is highly unusual. They don't normally do that. They get censored or whatever the case is, and sanctioned, excuse me. But as far as them losing their bar license and not being allowed to practice law, that's not something that's a commonplace. So as a result, the prosecutors continue doing what they're doing.
Well, Lamont, in your case, the prosecutor got a promotion, right?
Well, absolutely. I was wrongfully incarcerated here in the state of Colorado. Did 7 years for a crime I didn't commit. The Court of Appeals cited prosecutional misconduct and cited malicious misconduct. When I came back for my trial after 7 years for a new trial after the case was overturned, and I know the professor alluded to that they're not, protected against crimes that
immunity.
They commit. Immunity is not given to them. Well, in this particular case, in my case, what the prosecution did, the Colorado State Supreme Court, in their words, said that their actions were categorically wrong and was unacceptable to happen at any trial in the state of Colorado 3 months before I went to trial. Well, the prosecutor went in and conducted themselves against that law and that order by the state Supreme Court, and the Court of Appeals said they broke the law over 25 times in a day and a half period of testimony. So that's a break, that's a violation of law. But when I came back for my new trial, she is promoted. She's in a higher position of authority. Again, this is the message we send, and that's why the trust in the system is not there. You can just do what you want to do, and guess what? We'll have a cake and a celebration for sending a man to prison for 7 years that you took from me knowingly doing what you did, because you were warned by the state Supreme Court 3 months prior to my trial that it was categorically wrong to do what you did.
Right, and I believe Professor Lehman, you talked about, you know, when these prosecutors have track records of wrongdoing and they purposely go out and you know, bring in false evidence or whatever they do that is misconduct. The longest or the harshest, I would say, act that's been taken against one of them is one of them. I believe got 10 days in prison after, or in jail after, having a man spend 25 years in prison knowingly presenting wrong and false information about the trial. So you have that, and then, you know, I can't remember which
it's
one.
It's actually a little worse than that. He got 10 days, but he only served 3.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And that, I mean.
Oh, good time.
So I assume you're talking about Ken Anderson in Texas, I assume.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you have those type of numbers, I mean, we really need, the public really needs to understand and know that we as a whole need to go after these prosecutors with this immunity, because sure, they make mistakes, they're fallible, they're human, but when they abuse the system and say, hey, you know, so that I can keep my 99% conviction rate, I'm going to make up evidence, or I'm going to coerce witnesses to testify and things of that nature. And then you have, like, one of you mentioned in King County, New York, I believe the guy's name was Scarvelli or something like that.
Yeah, that was the investigator.
Right,
yeah.
That's the investigator. Yeah. And, I mean, they are reviewing 100 of his murder cases, and so far, I believe out of 70-something, they've only found 2 that they really say, yeah, that there was no misconduct, that these were truly the perpetrators of the crime. 2 out of 75. And when you have things of that nature, you say, okay, these are people that are in prison wrongfully and who were purposely put in there with misconduct. And so I'm glad to hear that, you know, that you guys see it the same way, that something needs to be done about this. And I'm sure your students can feel that pain, that, hey, when they find it, they have to be livid about what they find as far as when prosecutorial or judicial misconduct pops up in these cases that they review.
Professor Lehman, Professor Gross, thank you for joining us this evening. Professor Lehman, with your book that just came out regarding the Carlos de Luna case, how can folks get their hands on that?
The book is available through the Columbia University Press, and you can get it on Google or Amazon. So I encourage people to get it. It's in bookstores all over the country right now, too. The Wrong Carlos, Anatomy of a Wrongful Execution.
Professor Gross, the National Registry of Exonerations, you mentioned earlier that folks can reach out to you. But then as far as how can they get more information as far as the National Registry?
Go to ExonerationRegistry.org.
Okay, gentlemen. Thank you very much. We appreciate the information that you shared and your thoughts on the state of affairs with regard to, you know, where we are with so many innocent people that are incarcerated being exonerated. That's the good part of it. But, you know, you got people that have lost 30 years of their life and now being exonerated. And then you have some that have been executed only to find out that they were innocent after the fact. So, but we appreciate the thoughts and the input from Professor James Liebman from the Columbia University School of Law, as well as Professor Samuel Gross of the National Registry of Exonerations. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and close things out. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Don't go anywhere.
According to the Death Penalty Information Center, there have been over 1,000 people executed in the United States since 1976. The center goes on to say that there is no way to tell how many of those 1,000 people may have been innocent. The Death Penalty Information Center lists several cases where there is strong evidence of innocence. Here's one of their stories. This is the profile of Troy Davis, state of Georgia, convicted in 1991, executed in 2011. After a hearing on September 19, 2011, the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles denied clemency to Troy Davis despite presentation of testimony casting doubt on his guilt. Brian Kamer, one of Davis's attorneys, said, "I am utterly shocked and disappointed at the failure of our justice system at all levels to correct a miscarriage of justice." Davis's claims of innocence received international attention and calls for clemency by Pope Benedict XVI, former President Jimmy Carter, former FBI Director William Sessions, former Georgia Supreme Court Chief Justice Norman Fletcher, and others. Doubts about Davis's guilt were raised when some prosecution witnesses changed their stories after giving testimony against Davis, including accusations pointing to another suspect as the murderer of a police officer in Savannah, Georgia. The board heard testimony from a juror in Davis's original trial who says she had too much doubt about his guilt and would change her verdict. They also heard from a witness who originally testified against Davis, but recanted her testimony. Davis was executed late on the night of September 21st, 2011. The U.S. Supreme Court delayed the execution to consider final appeals, but then denied a stay. For more information on this and other cases on the execution of possibly innocent people, go to deathpenaltyinfo.org.
You are listening to
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Again, our sincere appreciation to Professor James Liebman and Professor Samuel Gross. You know, when you talk about wrongful convictions and the death penalty and executions, I mean, that's a subject that has so many arms and legs. And when you start talking about those with mental illness and so forth, and Cliff, you know, I was just looking at the deathpenaltyinformation.org. Even here, they just posted something a couple of days ago that says that Pennsylvania
has a 90% reversal rate for death penalty cases that are completing appeals. And so it's saying that over 60% of all death sentences imposed in the state have been overturned by state or federal courts. They're saying that, you know, of the 190 that remain on death row, they anticipate that most of those will be reversed.
And that ought to tell the whole state of Pennsylvania, we need to do away with the death penalty. Something in the way that we're implementing it is absolutely wrong. If you get the death penalty and you come back on appeal and they have to overturn it because of whatever reason, do away with it. Abolish it. Obviously, your state is not handling it right.
And you know, we're just looking at that stat on Pennsylvania. I mean, we could probably pick any state.
Yeah.
And just go down the line and look at their track record when it comes to death penalty cases. I mean, you look at Texas. I mean, Texas, we could pick any category. It doesn't even have to just be death penalty cases.
Right.
In almost every category in the judiciary, there is an issue sometimes that comes up there. And maybe, and you know, we've talked about that before. Is it because of the size of Texas? Is it because of the size of New York, the fact that their numbers are higher? But like you said, you know, injustice in any form is not right. And one person, you know, a person spending one day in prison unjustly is not right. And, you know, sometimes I do a lot of look up some of these quotes sometimes. And one of the ones that I like is where Benjamin Franklin, he said that, you know, justice will not be served until those who are unaffected are as outraged as those who are.
Absolutely.
Everybody needs to get outraged about
this. That's what it takes. And that's why I always say, you know, that everybody needs, the entire public, all of our listeners, you got to get out there. You got to make your voice heard. You have to do something. Nothing gets done by when people just sit in their living room and they scream at their television and saying, oh, this is wrong, this is wrong. You have to make your voice heard. Make it heard by voting, by doing some volunteer work, by doing something that says I agree with the law or I don't agree with the law, and it needs to be changed. Some of these things are just totally ridiculous. Your death penalty is at 90%, and they said the three people who were executed in Pennsylvania, they waived at least part of their appeals process. So that was the only reason they were executed.
Yep.
Otherwise, they would have been freed as well. So this really is sick. The more we learn here, the more it just tells you that we got to take part in fighting this. We have to. Otherwise, it just going to continue.
For archives of this evening's program, you can go to ajcradio.com. Again, ajcradio.com, and click on the link. And then you can also catch A Just Cause Radio, live365.com for 24/7 programming. Yes, if you like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. You can stay up to date on a daily basis through those social media vehicles. Also, every Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time, you can catch us on Progressive Radio Network, and you can get there by going to prn.fm. And then also, we can go to 405radio.com, and then that's one of our new partners. For information about the IRP6, go to freetheirp6.org, freetheirp6.org. We still have a couple of petitions out there that we're asking for your support on. Go to change.org, do a search on the IRP6. Also, you can go to moveon.org, and we have a new one out there for the IRP6 as well. That missing transcript of the sidebar conference between the IRP6 and federal judge Christine Arguello, we need that. We're calling on the Attorney General's office, Attorney General Eric Holder, to launch an investigation on that. And so, you know, we're just asking for your support from all of our listeners. Keep our brothers in prayer. Keep the IRP6 in prayer. David Banks, Dave Cipolla, Kendrick Barnes, Clint Stewart, Beatrice Hartford, Cliff.
Absolutely. We want to say thank you to our guest, Professor Samuel Gross, Professor James Liebman. Thank you guys for coming and spending the evening with us. We also want to say thank you to everyone in the chat room for all of your comments and your questions there. Thank you for your interaction. I want to say thank you to our production team.
K&D Productions, Captain Kyle and Dustin Jackson helping out Ill-Skilled Girl in the control room, making sure that you hear what it is that we have to say. Also to our production support team, giving us accurate and updated information so that we can deliver to you in a timely fashion. To the crew, I know you're out there. We appreciate it.
Lisa, as far as our phone campaign for the Attorney General's office, what are we trying to do there?
We're trying to get as many people as we can to call Eric Holder's office at 202-414-2003 or 2005 and request that they look into the missing transcripts of the case of the Viagra P6.
Join us each Tuesday and Thursday right here on A Just Cause Coast to Coast from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Lisa Cliff, Lamont, we'll do this again next week.
Absolutely. Good night. I'll be there.
All right. Thanks for joining us. Good night, America.
Good night.
Good night.